The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. And it would have to take a non-event at Stamford Bridge and a big result elsewhere for us not to lead with Thomas Tuchel's first game in charge of Chelsea. And so it goes. A non-event at the Bridge and Sheffield United's stunning win at Old Trafford means there's only one place to start. Many questions. Is the greatest of great escapes on? Ollie was really good on Monday. What is he on Thursday? And can anyone cling on to the slippery coattails of Manchester City? Leicester take just a point at Everton when it should have been three. Also, has Lars melted over Burnley's XG-defying win over Villa? Did anyone know Brighton and Fulham played? And does Thomas Tuchel hate young people? All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Natasha Henry, hello.
Hi, Max, how are you?
I'm tremendously well. Paul McInnes, hello.
Good day to you.
And Lars Sivertsen, welcome.
Good morning, Max.
Let's start at Old Trafford then. Manchester United 1, Sheffield United 2. A stunning performance from Sheffield United. December 1973 was their last win at Old Trafford when Dawn, whoever Dawn is, was at number one in the charts with Tie a Yellow Ribbon. Thank you, producer Ian, for that. That's why you're the best in the business. Natasha, you're astute. Did you see this coming?
I don't know if I saw it coming, but I wasn't surprised that Sheffield United actually challenged them for the game, that they could have won it. I've watched them a few times live this season, and they work hard, they're organised, but they've just struggled with scoring goals. And it kind of felt like United went in a bit too cocky, a bit too confident. They've been on a good run and maybe they didn't do their due diligence, I suppose would be the best way to describe it. But I think it's great for Chris Wilder and for the team because they've worked so hard and everyone supported him. The players love him, you know, the boardroom loves him and the fans adore him.
Lars, so many great performances from them. I thought Billy Sharp and I thought McGoldrick were great. Fleck played well. Jack Jelka, 38 years and 163 days old. Sad when you get so, you're either so young or so old that they put the number of days on your age, but that's where Jack Jelka's got to. I agree with Natasha that, you know, they've been close in games, haven't they? They've been like one goal out quite a lot of the time, but I thought they did look like a slightly different side. They just looked tougher and better than they'd been. Like certainly that game against Spurs that I remember.
Yeah, I do think it's harsh on them that they're like bottom with almost no points going into this because I'd say they haven't been the worst team in the league even. Hi West Brom. But they had this thing last season where they kept like just about tilting results in their favor. Like last season there were a lot of draws in there. There were a lot of one goal wins. And this season, I think the injury to Jack O'Connell has really hurt them. I think that the change in goalkeeper hasn't worked in their favour. There's just a couple of things that's just made them slightly less good, which when they were already winning on narrow margins is very bad. But you're right, there was a lot of effort went into this. And I wonder if actually the winning a couple of games in the Cup will have done them good as well. Because, I mean, the feeling in the squad can have been good after that run they were on. And maybe, you know, of course, getting that win against Newcastle, but also getting a couple of wins, albeit against lesser opponents in the Cup, possibly that raised spirits a little bit. Because they went out there looking like they believed they could get something.
And Paul, look, a sign that this is the greatest league in the world. Anyone can beat anyone.
I think this sort of play to Sheffield United have an attitude that is consistent with that take on the league. They fight and fight, and that's what they, you know, they're incredibly well organised. They've got a good game plan, but they fight. And I think that's something that I don't know. I think we saw more of it in that game yesterday than we'd seen for a while. And I don't quite know why that is. It could have been because it felt almost like a free hit playing a team that was, you know, going for the title at Old Trafford. United also very much let them into the game. I mean, United was slicing through them at will in the second half. The final touch was often a little bit too ornate. And I agree with Natasha's point from the very beginning. I think they came there thinking they could win it easily. And, you know, there's often a difficult balance to strike between being confident and being overconfident. But I think that period in particular, once they got the equaliser and that passage there in which they allowed Ollie Birkin to score the winner, well, the deflected winner, was typical of that. They just seemed to think that whatever position they took and whatever attitude they had, it would work out in their favour. And there was a series of about four or five kind of suboptimal decisions by United leading up to that goal. So for me, I was really, really pleased for Wilder because, you know, what he's done with that team and what he continues to do with that club is incredible. But I think if you were Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, you'd be incandescent after losing that game.
Paul, do you think Harry Maguire tapping it to De Gea and him just tapping it out was suboptimal during that second goal?
Yeah, for both of them. I mean, I for me, I kind of feel like De Gea should have put his foot through it, but maybe the angles weren't ideal, and Harry should have looked for something a bit simpler too. But yeah, for me, it was on the left hand side there. With they just gave them space to progress up the pitch, to play passes in and around, looking for the right crossing option, thinking, okay, well, you don't really have a striker that's going to hurt us. And you know, factually speaking, statistically speaking, that's kind of the case. But, you know, you keep on giving people opportunities, particularly in a game where Sheffield United, if it felt like, you know, we've got nothing to lose here, we're going to go for it, you know, asking for trouble.
The psychology of complacency is interesting, Natasha, isn't it? Because, you know, this is what they are there to do. They are there to turn up and win. And you know that you've got to keep winning because City are on such a good run. But even still, for elite athletes, it comes in, doesn't it? You could just... It must be so hard to keep repeating to a team, you're not just going to naturally win this game.
I mean, it's not just complacency. It's a bit of arrogance as well, the fact that they've gone into a game thinking, we're going to take all 3 points. This is Sheffield United. You know, they're at the bottom of the table. But I think one of the key things that Chris Wilder did is he's taken Ryan Brewster out of the starting lineup. And I watched him a couple of times when they were at home this season. And he's a young kid. He hasn't learnt his game. He doesn't know how to control the game as a forward that they need. They don't have a lot of possession, so he's not getting a lot of time on the ball. So someone like McGoldrick, who is experienced, who can just wait there, he knows he might not see the ball for 25, 30 minutes, but when he does, he will hold up play. But yeah, I think United, I wouldn't say it was naive from them. It's probably more arrogance than naivety.
I mean, just if they were complacent, if anyone in Man United who were complacent about this game, they need a slap, because this was their whole Achilles heel for such a long time under Solskjaer. If we go back to last season, you know, they lost to Watford, they lost to Bournemouth, they lost at home to Palace, they lost to Newcastle, they lost to Burnley, they dropped points to Villa, they didn't win any of the games against West Ham. Like, these sort of games where you expect United to go out and win as a matter of course, they were terrible at last season. Now, they've been a lot better this year, And they haven't messed up in the games where we sort of become used to seeing them mess up in. But surely they're aware at the back of their minds that, you know, this is where it's gone wrong for us in the past. That would be extraordinary if they were like, oh, this will be fine. Like, they've got no right to be. They haven't even earned the right to be slightly complacent. But I do wonder if the way they play, they are really reliant, I think, on individual players. Like, if Bruno Fernandes doesn't have a good day, I don't think they create as much otherwise. I thought they really missed Cavani early on in terms of his movement up front. And I mean, they are a team of individuals, really, when in the attacking sense. They do kind of wait for someone to do something extraordinary. I mean, Solskjaer said that. There was no magic, no space to run into, was his line. And they need one of those two things. They need space to attack, to get their runners into, or they need someone to do something magical. And that's still a bit of an issue. Now, recently, a lot of magic has happened. It's been a bit more sort of in the Harry Potter end of things.
And now we're in Paul Daniels and Wisbit. That's where we're
at. Yeah, a little
now.
Bit more sort of, yeah. David Blaine, maybe, I don't know. There was on the magic scale, it wasn't in the end you want it to be, but that's still a bit of an issue for the team, I think.
Paul, why are they so good away and so bad at home? Manchester United played 10, won 8, drawn 2 away. Top of the league for away performances, 10th from home. Played 10, won 4, drawn 2, lost 4. You know, without fans, that doesn't seem to make any sense to me.
I mean, it could simply be because of the way the opposition sets up against them in given circumstances. So away from home, they're more likely to come on. You've got the counter-attack option is there. At home, they sit in low block, narrow the spaces, and it's a different kind of game. And United, they sort of lack goals from midfield to a certain extent. I know Bruno's assist king from that sort of position. The winner, the popper winner the other week being a case in point of that. That's the sort of thing that sometimes, you know, you need to get around. A tight defence, but I don't actually think they had that much problem creating these spaces yesterday. I think particularly in the second half, they were in their groove. You know, they didn't make it work. Martial, his goal return this season has been poor. I think going back to Lars's point, you probably would have wanted to see Cavani earlier. And I just think there is a bit about United that there's not enough players in that team who just get the bit between their teeth and say, OK, we're going to drive this to a win. You know, they've got the ability, but do they have enough people who will clamber over their grandmother to get 3 points?
Are you saying they should? Roy Keane should still...
I just think a hologram of Roy Keane in the dressing room, or just haunting them on the pitch, you know, hovering over. You know, I feel, you know, obviously Bruno's that kind of player. But I was listening to before the game, talking about, you know, Pogba and how he's, you know, Pogba is finally in the form of his life and blah, blah, blah. And I think, you know, we had another game where Pogba was pretty quiet. For me, Pogba is a player who needs to, with the ability he's got and the stature he has, he needs to, there's nothing wrong to expect him to deliver his A game 9 times out of 10.
Jack John says, 18 years between Ampadu and Jagielka. Has there ever been a larger gap between outfield players on the same team? Natasha, you've done some research.
I know. I was really chuffed with this. So I've got three, actually, okay, now. I found two more. So we had Adnan Januzaj. I'm not sure if that's the right pronunciation. And Ryan Giggs.
Okay. What's the difference there?
So Giggsy was born 73 and Januzaj was born in 95, I think.
Okay, yeah, okay.
I have to double check because my phone, which we're using to record.
Right, I see. Okay, I've got 22 years there. That's good.
Then I've got Zlatan and Daniel Maldini.
Okay.
That's 20 years.
Right.
And then I've got Buffon, and I'm going to butcher his name, I apologise, Kulusevski for Juve, and that's 23 years good. Difference.
Lars?
Well, so the first one I thought of is, you know, European football connoisseurs will see this coming. Montpellier's defender Hilton, a Brazilian defender from Montpellier, he's still playing regularly for Montpellier. He's 43. It's quite extraordinary. He's 43 years of age and he's still playing regularly in Ligue 1 for Montpellier. He is 24 years older than their defensive midfielder, Joris Schuchard, who's played quite a bit. They do have a young striker who's 18 called Sepe Eliwahi. Sorry, on the subject of butchering names. Sorry. But who's 18. He hasn't played a lot, but they were briefly on the same pitch this season and the gap between them is 25 years. But there is one that's not going to be bettered here. And I think it counts because it is in a top tier league. Kazuyoshi Miura is still playing in Japan for Yokohama FC, and he's not a big part of their squad, obviously, but he's still on their books and he gets some game time now and again. He's 53. I swear to God, Kazuyoshi Miura, he's born in 67. And you think he's just hanging around because he's a good influence or whatever, but he did start a game in the J-League last season in September against Kawasaki, and also starting in this game, by the way, Shunsuke Nakamura, who's 43 now, so they like their old players at Yokohama. Now, starting in defence that day was a youngish man named Yuki Kobayashi, who is 20, born in 2000, so that's 33 years, 4 months, and 22 days between them. So I don't think that's going to get better at any time. When Miura was taken off in that game, he was replaced by a 19-year-old striker. So you had 34 years between the guy coming off and the guy coming on. Now, if you're wondering, I'm sure you are wondering, Max, Miura has signed a contract extension and will be part of Yokohama squad when the J-League kicks off in February. He played in Europe in the 90s. He played it one season in Genoa in 1994. Where he actually scored in the derby against Sampdoria, who had David Platt, Ruud Gullit, and Roberto Mancini in the team. He's still knocking about, King Kazu. And the J-League is a top-tier league. You got to take it seriously.
Yeah, gives hope to us all. Vincent says, how many examples are there of a team whose away kit is the combination of the two colours of their home kit, like Sheffield United? Did they just, get the home kit straight off the wash and the red bled into the white and just made quite a fetching pink kit? Burnley 3, Villa 2. Jordan says, after the latest Dyche masterclass, how does Lars now admire Burnley? On XG, this was 0.77, Burnley 0.77, Villa 2.94. A sort of travesty, Lars, that Grealish was on the losing side yesterday.
It was. For me, it was a reassuring return to normality because Burnley haven't quite been Burnley this season. They'd only scored 10 goals the whole season before this, which is obviously not good. This puts them at 13, which is still not good. But actually, they've scored less and fewer, goals than their XG would suggest that they should, which, as we all know, is, you know, awfully, completely off-brand for Burnley. So this was the sort of a return to the incredibly frustrating yet impressive Burnley ways of old. And we had a comment of someone asking, like, how would McNeil be rated if he played for a bigger team? And I think there's an interesting question there. I think we underestimate Burnley players, but I think the attacking players at Burnley who don't get a lot of chances to do their stuff because the ball doesn't come their way there often. It would be interesting to see them play for a team that has more possession and gets the ball to them more often. Like, how good could Ashley Barnes and Chris Wood be if they played up front for a team that actually created a lot of chances for them? I think that's a really interesting question.
Paul, what did you think of this? I thought Chris Wood's header was utterly brilliant, and like sometimes we sort of gloss over great headers because it didn't look spectacular, but to arch your neck and to place that ball under pressure is actually superb centre forward play.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's their win came from doing well what Burnley do well, and I think there must be some kind of calculation that can be created that sort of accommodates within a thing like XG a specialism of a team for doing that sort of stuff. Now, Dwight McNeil's only had 2 assists all season, so they've obviously not been doing what they can do. There's a thing, that's a long-term thing with Burnley, which is how do you keep motivating these players to perform above themselves when it's pretty clear that there's a ceiling on how far they can go. And I guess sort of one way is to be completely humiliated by your opponents in the first 45 minutes of a match, and then that allows your manager to sort of actually put his foot up your pants in the dressing room. Maybe they should try that more often.
And we didn't really discuss, because Thursday night games are tricky for us, because once Monday pod comes around, there's a weekend of games. Natasha, we haven't really talked on the pod about Burnley winning at Anfield as well. I mean, that is 2 brilliant wins, and the one at Anfield, like, to end that run of, I don't know what it was, almost 70 games, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Is extraordinary. And like, they did that brilliantly as well.
I think we have to give a lot of credit to Sean Dyche. I think a lot of people seem to underestimate him and his team. It's like, you know, Burnley, they're just grafters. They'll just try and get a ball from a set piece. But he showed again last night, they were getting battered. He changed it at halftime. They came out and won the game. And like you say, Grealish was great. You know, you got Barkley there. It's not like Villa, a team that you can just walk all over. And I honestly expected them to win. So I was surprised that Burnley got 3 points. But I think he's showing that they can work hard, but they can find that bit of flair when they need it. I think we can call it the Tony Pulis situation. People have this vision of his team. They're just grafters. But they can do more than that. And the manager can encourage them to do more than that.
Who was the flair under Pulis? I mean, Big Sam had it, right? With Okocha and you know, Djorkaeff.
Didn't Pulis have Shaqiri?
Or was that in the Mark Hughes reboot, I wonder?
So he had the Turkish flair player whose name escaped me for a moment as well.
Tuncay.
Yeah. He got Tuncay, yeah.
They can't play like showy and flashy all the time because they'll get battered and they'll concede too many goals. The players they have in their squad, they have to be defensive and hope they can win 1-0 or win by 1 goal. But yeah, I say fair play to them. And, you know, Liverpool got beaten again, so they're not going to be invincible. So it's all good.
Claret says, any thoughts on the tweet from the official Aston Villa account? I think it's been deleted. It was like 22nd minute, says, we're at Turf Moor, so obviously our striker's been on the end of a dreadful challenge. Tarkowski goes in the book. I mean, we've had this with official accounts before, and I know it is just a person, you know, it's not a PLC tweeting, but it does feel, Paul, a little bit, just sort of a bit cheap, doesn't it?
Yeah. This is where my sort of tedious working expertise can come in handy, because I don't spend as much time watching football anymore as I would like to. I spend a lot more time sitting on Zoom calls with governing bodies, and this week they Deloitte, the accountants, released one of their series of reports into money in football, and looking at what they call the money league, the top 20 richest clubs in Europe, and Barcelona are top and holding their place, And I think Manchester United are fourth and lost an awful lot of money this past year. But one of the things they were observing was that because of the pandemic, because of a massive loss of revenue, it's forced clubs to spend a lot more time and money on improving their digital offering, trying to get their connect with their fans when they're stuck at home, which again sort of further merges that mass of the fan who goes to the stadium, the real fan, and the fan who just sits in their pants watching telly, the new fan. And you know, one of the ways in which people do this is, you know, they have a subscription channel, or they have shows, or they have whatever. But the easiest way and the most direct way is having a Twitter account that gets you lots of interactions. And how do you get people interacting with you? Well, you add personality, and you also add controversy. And, you know, I think we've got used to, over time, clubs being pretty just nice and personable and bland. But as we've seen with, you know, a lot of other brands that aren't football, over time, you know, the way you get an edge, the way you sort of get people to engage is to be more controversial. This sort of stuff where you're actually going to see more clubs being like, no, we are the fans. We're just like you, the fans. We can expect to see more of that, yeah.
It's an interesting conversation. And I'm sorry you have to spend so much time on Zoom calls with governing bodies, Paul. But when we do the Zoom call with governing bodies special, you will be you will be our main guest. Yeah. All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin at Stamford Bridge. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Cormac writes, does Thomas Tuchel need more time? Chelsea nil, Wolves nil. One of my friends is a Chelsea season ticket holder and was on a WhatsApp group with his Chelsea fans. Like, irate at the starting 11 that Thomas Tuchel picked. Like genuinely, and he's quite a mild-mannered person. There were lots of Fs, and I think even one C in there. Like, so furious that Mason Mount had been left out. He also left out Tammy Abraham, Reece James. No place in the squad for Billy Gilmore. There is a danger, Lars, in reading too much into this. What message did his starting 11 send out to you?
Yeah, I think there's a danger reading too much into it. He's had one training session with the team, but he will also have been watching them, presumably, and he's not a fool. He will have been aware there's a chance he could end up being in charge of these guys. I do think the sort of agony and outrage over the Chelsea kids feels, you know, bordering on condescending a little bit. I mean, Tammy Abraham is 23. He's played for four different clubs. He's played over 200 games. Mason Mount is 22. Like, these aren't sort of Dickensian street urchins who they sort of found on the King's Road a few hours before the game. Like, these are fairly established sort of professionals, England internationals. You know, if they're good enough, they'll get in the team. And if the manager thinks someone else is good enough, then that's kind of football.
Barney made quite an interesting point. Not that interesting, actually. It's quite an obvious point that, you know, Havertz and Pulisic are younger than Mount and Abraham. Foreigners can be young too. It was interesting though, Natasha. I spoke to Ben Foster yesterday about, you know, a new manager coming in. Obviously, he plays for Watford. He has a new manager every 2 weeks, and he was saying that players really do read a lot into like a first starting 11. You know, that they go, what, you know, whoa, I'm not in this team, and you sort of wonder if Mason Mount will be almost like his Dele Alli. Like, everyone will notice if Mount's playing, it'll be a story. If Mount isn't playing, it'll be a story. If he's brought on, it'll be a story. If he's taken off, it'll be a story. So there's sort of no way. And I am pouring fuel, yeah, on that story right now.
I mean, yeah, I think Mount is, he was described as Lampard's favourite son or favourite player, that kind of thing. There is always those managers that have really close relationships with some players. And obviously Lampard is probably an idol to kids that have come through Chelsea's youth squad. So I do think if a new manager came into my work and suddenly I wasn't getting to go to the Champions League games or the Premier League games, I would start to feel like, am I doing something wrong? So I think it's only natural. But I feel like he's coming. He's been there, what, 48 hours? Not even that. I don't think you can read into that. He's probably picked the players that he's aware of most, or the people that work hardest in training, which doesn't necessarily mean they're better on the pitch or in a game. You know, some players don't train well, but they're great on the pitch. So maybe once he spends some more time, he'll see something different and his squad will change. I think give him like 10 games and then we can talk about does he not like kids and all that kind of stuff.
I mean, it was a straight choice of Havertz over Mount, wasn't it? That was the setup. So I think there is it's very difficult not to look at that and think there is some kind of there's been a conscious decision for one over the other. I mean, the argument being that he went for a more experienced team, and I did the presser with him after the game, and he was raving about the team, but then sort of basically revealed he was pretty worried that they were going to lose if they didn't set up quite defensively. I thought it was quite revealing. But can I go just a little bit Guardian Easter? I sort of felt it was just a bit weird listening to this erudite, highly educated, progressive, modern German coach speaking fluent English in the current climate. It just felt a bit out of date. And he was talking about sort of 16 ball recoveries in the final third and things like that. And you were like, are you aware of what the Chelsea fan base is currently feeling right now? And, you know, and not just that, but the sort of idea that you're going to pick sort of an unproven European import over, you know, a golden boy English kid. It just felt like a little bit, I felt sorry for him really, because I felt like you're probably going to get a lot of stuff chucked at you if you keep on going like this. And whether you deserve it or not even sure. The time, I sort of feel the same for Jurgen Klopp a bit. I feel like, you know, Jurgen coming over here and doing all this, you know, and being sort of like such a marvellous human being. And then at the end of the day, sort of the direction the country's going on is a completely other way. I feel like, well, yeah, maybe, I wonder whether things might get quite sticky quite quickly for Tuchel if the results don't go. And let's face it, the performance wasn't that great. One good running cross from Hudson-Odoi, who you're not going to get away with him playing in that position many times. And, you know, when you're playing against the Wolves without any confidence, who are going to sit back and just try and defend the whole game, maybe. But anybody who wants to attack that space is going to have joy in future.
I mean, the quote is great when he says, I think supporters would have liked what they saw. 16 recoveries in the last third is proof of energy on the pitch. It's like, it's a funny thing to say. I also really like, Lars, the sort of amazement that his English is so good, as if he only started learning it yesterday.
Sure, we don't get a lot of the English out for him.
Exactly. He only arrived in London yesterday and he's already fluent in English. This guy's a complete genius. Pravesh says, I haven't paid much attention to Tuchel's tactics in the Bundesliga or at PSG. Can Lars explain, like, the tactical prowess of Tuchel?
I think it's hard because I think he's been at three very different clubs that have had three very different situations and have put three very different types of demands off of him. His Mainz team was very typical for what we sort of associate with sort of this new generation of German coaches, very hard-running, high-pressing. I guess the most eye-catching thing, they were very flexible tactically. They could change formation a lot according to what the opposition were doing. Whereas at Dortmund, it was clear that he's perhaps more influenced by Pep Guardiola than a lot of other coaches of his background. I mean, he definitely made Dortmund more possession focused and had them keep the ball a lot more. And at PSG is a really hard club to analyze because, I mean, they're going to have a ton of possession and roll over most of their teams domestically anyway. But I do think I would expect him to be more possession focused than they're used to. Than Chelsea fans are used to seeing. So there's definitely a kind of a, I think we see the beginnings of a culture war, my friends, and I think it might actually be a bit of an advantage for him that there's no fans in the stadium at the moment because he's coming in replacing, you know, Chelsea's brave Frank Lampard, who's been unjustly and cruelly thrown away. And there will be a lot of this. I suspect we'll have a lot of the Sarri discussions, you know, because they will be looking to keep possession. Obviously, it's not going to be as mad as against Wolves because Wolves just sat back and had no intention of coming out and attacking them or doing anything. So you do end up with like 1,000 sideways passes. But he is a coach who likes to have his team control possession and keep possession a lot, which traditionally, I mean, if the Sarri year taught us anything, is that with the match-going fans at Stamford Bridge, that doesn't go down very well. And their fan base who have seen their team be very successful playing direct football and be, you know, get the ball forward quickly. That's what they like to see, and that's what the team has been successful doing. So they had very, very little time for sort of Jorginho passing it sideways 700 times per game. And I suspect we'll see quite a bit of that.
Yeah, I do wonder, Natasha, actually, if if Wolves was quite a difficult first game for him, in, as been mentioned, because they did absolutely park the bus, didn't they? It's weird what's happened to Wolves without Jimenez, and you know, they've lost obviously a couple more players, you know, Jota and Doherty as well, but they would have approached that game differently, I think, last season even.
It feels like they've lost their spark. I think that's the only way to describe it. I mean, 21% possession, no shots on target. I mean, 9-10 months ago, we, you know, that's a Sheffield United or a West Brom. You would never expect Wolves to be playing like that. But I think even though they are playing like that, they're still picking up points, which is the key thing. And even if you're not winning games with beautiful football, if you pick up a point at Stamford Bridge, you're going to be happy at the end of the day. Nuno's not going to go home and be angry because he knows that point could be vital come the end of the season. But I think the players might start to get downhearted, you know, been playing this wonderful attacking football, and now all of a sudden they're just sitting back and waiting to be got at.
Yeah. I mean, and look, Wolves haven't won since beating Chelsea in, what, the 15th of December. So, like, they're on a terrible little run, aren't they? So I think you're right. Yeah, a point is good for them.
What's sad for me is the it's not a decline, but just the disappearance really of Adama Traore. I mean, last season I really thought we were about to see a new superstar in the game, and this season he, you know, in part of that front three, it was like Podence, you know, was the one who was using his physicality more on the pitch. Neto was the one with the tricks and the pace. And Traore is just a passenger. I have no clue why that's the case. Maybe he wanted to leave for Liverpool, maybe blah, 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 maybe nothing. But it's sad because I really loved watching him play last season.
He was the most fun. And now Tanguy Ndombele is the most fun.
Yes,
even if I'm biased.
True words.
Everton 1, Leicester 1. Lovely goal from James Rodriguez. Proof that he has a right foot and quite a good one. Ancelotti saying, unbelievable, I don't remember him scoring with his right foot before. But his first goal in 4 months. Leicester, I thought, Lars, were the better side here by quite a lot and might see it as 2 points drop.
Yeah, they were and they will. And it's a bit of an obvious thing to say, but no, Vardy is bad for them. You know, he is phenomenal. He's a phenomenon, Jamie Vardy. And you do wonder with the amount of time they spent attacking in this game and the number of times they were able to get into sort of Chelsea's the final third, if they'd had Jamie Vardy lurking, then they would have found a winner here, because they deserve to win the game. And I find Everton a very difficult team to work out this season. I've seen a lot of games in which they haven't looked very impressive, but they are finding ways of getting points. And there they are in seventh with two games in hand compared to some of the teams above them. So that's pretty good. That's very impressive stuff by Carlo, I think. But you're right, Leicester will be slightly disappointed they couldn't get the winner here.
Nice and philosophical, Natasha Ancelotti afterwards on Jordan Pickford's his mistake for the Tielemans goal. The view of Jordan wasn't so good. I mean, it's true. It went through a crowd of players, didn't it? He said he can do better, but it doesn't matter.
it kind of feels like he's just accepted the fact that Pickford has a mistake in him like every six or seven games, because he's just so nonchalant about it now. It's like, yeah, it happens, you know, we still got the point kind of attitude. But he's making these mistakes so regularly, and then you see like Pope at Burnley having an absolute blinder, keeping them in the game. And you have to start asking questions. You know, is Pickford really the number one English goalkeeper, even though he is Gareth Southgate's number one English goalkeeper? Because it doesn't seem like he is at the moment. The stats show that he's not.
Paul, if you were Gareth Southgate, who was there watching, would you say he's been really loyal to Pickford, who was good in the World Cup, you know, but...
Yeah.
He's so frantic, isn't he?
Yes, he is. And at international level, you know, quite a lot of the time, they're not going to matter because England play teams that they're expected to beat and generally beat. But if it happens in the one game you need to win against a team that's better than you, then it's cataclysmic. But I think, you know, the thing that Pickford has in his locker, which some of his rivals don't, is his ability with his feet. And that's what, you know, one of the main reasons that Southgate values him, because of what he brings to the team in that regard.
Does Dean Henderson have that in his feet? Does anybody know? I mean, I've seen a bit of him. I think he because you understand that Pope isn't brilliant with his feet, or we don't really get to see that at Burnley, but you wonder if Henderson does have.
Yeah, I can imagine that he does. I mean, he didn't really have to do that much. I mean, he's very good saving with his feet for Sheffield United. I mean, he didn't have to do much playing with it for them. But we just, you know, do you not kind of think now Dean Henderson made the wrong choice? I mean, we've hardly seen him at all this season.
True. Dan says, was anyone else genuinely stunned to discover Brighton and Fulham played last night? I flicked over by accident at half time in the United game. I've never been so shocked to see a football match taking place. Was anyone aware that this was happening?
I had it on the second screen.
Right, because they hid it, Lars, at 7:30. I don't quite understand why
they slipped
the 6 o'clock games and the 8 o'clock games, the 8:15 games, and then they sort of hid this one like it was the child they were embarrassed about.
It was the middle child.
Yeah, exactly.
The middle child. Well, I was really interested in this because I think
massive game.
Yeah, and Fulham have kind of there have been the beginnings of something there, and I'm starting to worry about Brighton, and I really like Graham Potter, so I don't really want them to be in trouble. So this was really interesting, and it was another game. Again, I had it on the second screen, so I didn't analyze it in minute detail, but I could see Brighton had a good number of chances there, and they just cannot score. Like, I mean, in a lot of games anyway, their forwards are they really lack a goal scorer there, something tremendous. And whereas I felt on the other hand it was a bit of a step back for Fulham, who've had a lot of games recently against strong opposition where they performed better than expected, but they're not getting a lot of points. And in the situation they're in the league, this is the kind of game where they really need to sneak a win if they're going to climb out of it, and they just weren't really there, and Brighton were unfortunate not to get there. And but really, Brighton, I've seen so many Brighton games this year where they've done a lot of right things right and they just can't get the points, and partially because Matt Ryan was terrible at the start of the season, but also like their forwards are not scoring goals, and it's a problem. I'm not sure how you solve it.
IMHO, Potter overrated, Parker underrated, and I think Brighton have spent a lot of money and they still don't have a team that works. They play, you know, they look good on the eye and that's great, but you know, at the end of the day, they don't score enough goals, they don't win enough games. I think Fulham, meanwhile, coming up from the playoff positions, essentially rebuilding their entire team, not spending an enormous amount of money like they did last time, and at the same time not spending nothing. I think they look, from when I've seen them, they're very well organised, they're very cohesive, and they have an idea. They actually, you know, they lack a striker. I think the problem with Mitrovic is that he can't play in this system that they want to play in the league, which requires a bit more movement. That's where they sort of hit the buffers a little bit. But I think in terms of Parker getting the best out of a lot of the players he's brought, particularly Ademola Lookman this season, Ruben Loftus-Cheek had a great game yesterday. I kind of feel like they are, you know, they win their game in hand. They're very close to reeling in Brighton and or Newcastle. And I wouldn't rule them out staying up.
I mean, that's the question, isn't it, Natasha? You know, Newcastle on this absolutely terrible run. Brighton can't score goals. Newcastle on 19 points from 20. Brighton on 18 from 20. Fulham on 13 from 19. West Brom 11 from 20. And Sheffield United 8 from 20. Given what happened yesterday, obviously we're so reactive, aren't we? But Sheffield United do look like they're more likely to pick up points than West Brom. You know, if you were guaranteed one is gone, you'd say West Brom. I would anyway.
Yeah.
Did you see, you know, and Fulham look nicer than the others. I don't know who you think who might drop down.
I mean, 100%. Scott Parker was disappointed in his post-match interview. He admitted this is the kind of game we need to be taking all 3 points from because, you know, they're not expecting to pick up the points against the City or the United. But yeah, I feel like West Brom, I mean, I don't even think Big Sam can save their team this season. They're shipping goals. I mean, what is it, 48 goals they've conceded in 20 games? I mean, that's relegation form. But Fulham feel like, for me, they're more of a team than Brighton. Even if they're not scoring as many goals, they look organised, everyone knows their job, and they do have some good players there. Harrison Reed, Bobby Decker-Dover-Reed, you know, Tom Kearney. They have players that can, and Cavalera, you know, they're growing into themselves. I think they're learning the Premier League quicker this time around than they did last time. And he hasn't brought in too many how should we say, big names. So it's definitely a good team spirit there. I think they'll be okay, but I think Brighton and Newcastle really have to start worrying and start picking up some points.
Yeah, I agree very much with Natasha. I think that's put very well. I think, yeah, Fulham have a team and I think Brighton have a philosophy.
What's more important, though, in the modern era, Paul?
I believe a team will get you more points, but I've been wrong before.
Right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll look ahead to the weekend's games, bit of Spurs-Liverpool tonight, and any other business as well. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Spurs-Liverpool is tonight, so you will have to listen to this quickly if a preview of that game is to mean anything to you. Lars, review the game for those small percentage who the first thing they do when the pod is released is listen to it.
Well, I'm very surprised that this ended 6-6. I mean, I didn't really see that coming. And the sort of the Eric Dier double hat trick is not really something that you expect. But I guess it's just a weird year, and this is the kind of thing that happens. You know, Mourinho will be pretty unhappy with how that went. What did you say? Preview? I thought
it's a big game for both sides, Natasha.
It is a huge game. I think Liverpool on this really weird run of not being able to get over the line, get results, and everyone's starting to question them. So I feel like a trip to Spurs is a great opportunity for them to like reassert themselves as champions. I mean, he said at the start of the season, we're going to fight to keep our title. Now is the time to show that you're fighting. And Jose Mourinho, there was a piece in The Guardian, I think it was yesterday. He was quite calm and very chilled, but he still managed to put a little dig in there about Klopp jumping up and down the touchline and how when he did it, he got punished. So, you know, there is that underlying rivalry. I mean, Jose would love to beat Klopp. I think we would see a happy Jose for a change if they got all 3 points. But I feel like it's going to be a score draw. I think both teams are likely to concede goals as well as having the players to score goals. So, yeah, I'm expecting a score draw, but it should be fun either way.
I'm expecting, as with my Spurs allegiance, I have just convinced Liverpool are going to win this game. But I hope I'm wrong. Now, at the weekend, the big game is Arsenal-Manchester United. Could be Martin Ødegaard's yes. first game. Chris says, will Lars enjoy his job as much now he's staring down the barrel of 6 months of perpetual questions about Ødegaard?
I think what you're failing to understand then is Norwegians, we were so bad for a pretty long time, and now we have we have some really good players, and one of them coming to Arsenal is exciting. Come on, we haven't exactly been spoiled over the last decade of having players at big clubs, so this is exciting to me, and I think it's a good move for him in so much as he needs to play. He appears to have fallen into that sort of awful category of players who Zidane doesn't fully trust, and once you're in that category, it's hard to get back. And he needs the minutes. And I was intrigued by the line that's sort of being pushed on the Norwegian side of things from Ødegaard, is that Arsenal very much convinced him to come, you know, because there was the possibility of maybe going back to Real Sociedad, even though David Silva is there, so he might not walk into the team quite the way he did last season. But that he was convinced by what was proposed to him by Mikel Arteta. So Arsenal clearly have a very defined idea of how they want to use him. I think he can add a lot to their game. I mean, Arsenal throughout the season, they really struggled to attack through the middle. I mean, that's why we had this sort of weird phase where they keep throwing crosses in to not very tall forwards, because there was nothing happening through the middle for them. Emile Smith Rowe coming in has made them a lot better in that respect, but I think relying on him to do it for them in every game for the rest of the season probably wouldn't be wise. So, and I think he can do a lot of what they were, you know, the people who, there are similarities between him and Mesut Ozil. I mean, he's a pretty different guy and he's a pretty different player, but that's sort of a player who would sort of flit around and pick passes, very good close control, can see the space. He can add some of the things they weren't getting from Ozil, I think.
Natasha, you're an Arsenal fan. Weirdly calm at the moment?
Yeah, I am. Man United historically has always been a big game for us. The years have gone by and it's no longer the two of us fighting for the title. But I feel like Arsenal are going into it in a better position than they would have done last season. There's a lot more calm. There's a lot more organisation. And the Southampton game, you know, that was a game they would have lost 2-1 last season. They they got their heads down, they knuckled down, they weren't trying to play fancy, pretty football or make it a really showy goal. They just did the simple things well. And I think that's often been a problem with Arsenal, is that they don't do the simple things well. Once you get that base, then you can build, then you can impress. And I think, you know, Saka and Smith Rowe, they brought an energy to the team, to the squad. You know, when you watch those two play, it is like watching two kids on the school pitch, and the others around them seem to be enjoying that and taking enjoyment from that. So United like to play away, and they're going to be angry after losing. But I think fingers crossed.
Natasha, as an Arsenal fan, are you concerned that young Smith Rowe, who has done very well, might now lose his place to a foreign interloper who might only be there for a few months? Is this something that you might not want to see as a fan? Could we have a mini Havertz Mount schism here?
No, I feel as long as Arteta handles the situation, if that's the case, then if Arteta handles the situation in a calm manner, then it shouldn't be a problem. If he says to Smith Rowe, you know what, you've played a lot of games this season, I don't want to burn you out. It's not a case of I'm dropping you or getting rid of you. It's just me managing your progression. Then there shouldn't be a problem. You know, we're all grown-ups. And if you explain it to him, rather than just you're not on the bench or you're on the bench and then don't talk to him, you know, we're not in that old school era anymore. And Arteta, I think he'll be great for Odegaard, because he looks like the kind of player that needs a manager to put his arm around him. You know, show him a bit of love. And if we benefit from that, I'm all for it.
Quick pronunciation tip from Martin Odegaard. Like, no one's expecting everyone to get this right, but the easiest thing to remember, don't worry about the D at the end. Like, that's essentially silent.
Ah, okay. Odegaard.
Yeah, Martin Odegaard is... that's one little thing that'll make it more accurate immediately.
Thank you so much, Lars Iverson. Now, West Ham-Liverpool, that could be an exciting game, couldn't it? Southampton-Villa as well. The rest of the Premier League games, you will know them or you'll see them happening. They're all on the television. Quick note, in the WSL, exactly 2 years since their last defeat in the competition, Chelsea now unbeaten in their last 32 league matches, setting a new record for the longest unbeaten run in the competition. We'll do more WSL soon. We'll do more EFL soon as well. We have let that slip a little bit. Paul, would you like to do a minute on Norwich City? Because you're doing all right.
We're doing fantastic. Great result for us last night. A draw between Swansea and Brentford, who look like the other two strongest sides in the division now. The general consensus is the league is a bit weaker this season, giving us a week. I think Norwich, we're grinding out results. Well, we're not even grinding out results. We're hitting form right now. So, and the great thing about Martin Ødegaard coming to Arsenal is that they didn't end up trying to make a serious bid for Emi Buendia. So long may that continue. Please turn that loan into a permanent move, Mikel.
We'll finish with this from Yon John. Not a question, but I strongly believe that every player that celebrates a pregnancy by putting the ball under his shirt, i.e. Almiron, also has to let the world know how things went by birthing a ball a few months later.
He needs to score every 3 months, lie down on the pitch and have his teammates perform a scan.
Right, okay. With the gel.
Yeah.
I'm not an expert in this. Okay. So an ultrasound every 3 months.
Yeah.
And then he births a ball. And if he has twins, he gets another ball off one of the cones. Wow, okay. Well, look, we'll keep it. Miguel, if you're listening, that we'd greatly appreciate this. And that'll do for today. Lars, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Natasha.
See you later.
Thank you, Paul.
Peace.
Peace. And you'll be back for the Governing Bodies special. And we will be back not to talk Governing Bodies on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.